Well, let's make a start. I'm very pleased again to welcome Professor Billy Moria to the last Shiv Dasani seminar. And he's going to speak to us on Indian practical ethics, law, gender, justice, ecological and bioethical challenges.
Thank you very much. It's a great honour. I mean, it's always a challenge to present seminars or do lectures, because then I get to write. Motivates me, right? Otherwise, I'm too lazy. And I'm certainly not going to be able to get through, as you can see, it's already a fairly large paper, all the issues. So I think I might leave out ecological, but try and cover as much as of the other. And this is a theoretical paper, as much as it is on sort of recounting case issues. The last thing that a philosopher would do is to say, "Oh, here are the problems, 1, 2, 3." They would not do that. They would first theorize about everything else and theories of justice and so on, and then give you some case studies. So that's exactly what I'm going to approach. I hope this is not too the introductory part is not too too theoretical, but I need a framework without which I can't ground the sort of case studies that I'm looking at. This present work comes out of it's a sequel actually to Indian Ethics, Classical and Contemporary Challenges, of work that came out about 2007-2008. It's a collected piece, but I did the introduction and some major articles, chapters in it. And this is a sequel, this is chapter, book two rather, volume two, specifically on issues of gender, justice, ecology and bioethical issues. One of the co-editors, she passed away while we were doing this work, so I'm just continuing, as happened to be my wife, I'm continuing that work in her name, with a lot of contributions that are coming from people that she had already solicited from or I have found since. This particular work calls for deeper analysis of technical and highly theoretical ethical issues that appear not to be conclusive, as changes in context embracing a wider range of issues and perspectives are always possible. Yet the horizon of the possible provides a foothold for the beginning of a new dialogue around ethical practices by negotiating encounters or exchanges that do not seriously entertain the borrowed voices of the native informant. Still, there is little else to go by. We can only go by what they call the native informants, the people whose voices that we want to speak for. But then one rightly asks, who speaks for women? More particularly, who speaks for feminism, Indian women, and the subaltern? Subaltern being those that are the lowest strata of existence or life in a society. In recent years, there has been a growing body of literature on ethics within non-conventional or non-mainstream frameworks, such as feminist and post-colonial, that move towards micro-ethical formulations rather than continuing faith in grand narratives. These emerging frameworks are the subject of debate among critical theorists, and they're also becoming central to a number of sub-disciplines. In current times, awareness of the impact of globalization has affected most areas of discourse, just as narrative theory, postmodernism, and postcolonialism had in the later half of the previous century. It is this search for contemporary perspectives that, in part, has motivated the currently underway project. Understandably, some philosophers, mostly women, but men among them too, elsewhere have looked to moral philosophies that are less encumbered by unabashed rationalism, but that might be more grounded in basic affects and emotions. This is where the role of caring or care ethics, that Carol Gilligan is known for, the empathic response and a morality that does not shy away from love and affection as preeminent gifts that have become focal points in French feminist response to ethical challenges after Simone de Beauvoir, Simone Weil, in the works of Levinas, Kristeva, Irigaray, and so on. Take, for example, the practice of infanticide. One could follow a fairly straightforward historical sociological review of an age-old yet continuing contemporary problem in India. But one could also imaginatively take the emotions aroused by this practice to orientate oneself ethically towards a radically different response to this often profoundly subjective discussion on violence, subjugation, dominance, and the rights of the unborn child. What then does the writer do with the inner feelings of disgust, pity, rage that this practice induces in her? Should these emotions form part of a scholarly response, which the hard social sciences approach would urge, is anathema to the objective research? Or does the researcher deal with this uncanny anxiety that wells up in her, that she too may not have existed given different circumstances, a prenatal intervention dictated by a parental decision or cultural preference or some coercive state policy? In other words, and I'm not even going into the case study, it's just basically asking, what do you do with the emotions that such situations arouse? Does that become part of your ethical theory, or do you just remain detached and give sort of figures and statistics and so on and say how horrible this is? And that's it. How then does one forge a coherent theory out of one's own emotional response, a theory which reconciles the hard fields of ethics and developmental imperatives with the unvoiced subjectivity of the child girl who, too, one feels aspires to self-esteem, a productive career, and a fulfilling life? Here the project of making meaningful sense of culture, tradition, and modernity in an applied praxis of living confronts the researcher in the face. It presents challenges to mainstream conceptions of gender, law, and justice in relation to areas such as infanticide, personal law, gender inequity, violence, religious identity, bride burning, migration, migration stress effects, health, erased subjectivity, and so on. What then is the locus of thinking in relation to the practice of infanticide or any one of these acts of violation against the right to existence, livelihood, and care for the other? A disembodied, unborn female may well live on in the moral unconscious of society. Given the global nature of our world, what structures of thinking can be brought to bear on the ethical problem? What of poverty and global death? Where are these factors located in the scheme of things? Is there justice for the gendered other? Might a non-Western feminist perspective on justice be a desirable ideal? Now, in the next part, and I'm going to sort of skip some of this, is a moral discussion of a universalist theory of justice that people like Nussbaum, who to some extent followed Amartya Sen, have argued for. And this is based on what Amartya Sen formulated and Nussbaum sort of developed further, called capabilities. So it's a sort of a business of capabilities. What capabilities are is this, it's the suggestion that the capabilities is that people are given certain basic entitlements, certain basic rights, and once these are guaranteed, then justice in terms of equality. Once people have sort of equality of capabilities and the entitlements which allow capabilities of an individual to function, then there is guarantee of equality of rights and interests, and so on. So it's a sort of an affirmative constitutional support that allows people to flourish and grow, but also in terms of being given certain goods. So capabilities come with certain goods. So, for example, education, welfare, and she has about 10. Martha Nussbaum lists about 10 capabilities, namely the ability to live, bodily health, bodily integrity, the senses or the cultivation of the senses, imagination and thought, emotions, practical reason, affiliation, the ability to live with other species, play and laughter, and have control over the political and material environment. Now, of course, you know, some of these would probably not even apply to, you know, women in certain conditions, or children even in certain conditions and so on, circumstances. But it's an abstract theory, it's a general theory, and one applies as much of this as possible. But she believes, and it's very appealing. I mean, you think, well, what more do you want? Ability to live, bodily health, you know, integrity, and so on and so forth. It seems at least from sitting in Chicago or Brown University, a fairly comprehensive kind of a package, right? Whenever this was sort of presented, she has, you know, she has been attacked, and so once in Delhi, I was there. In fact, the chairperson intervened towards the end, concluding and demurely said, "Nussbaum's lecture fails to elaborate on how gender justice can be achieved by developing countries." Now, the point of saying this is that these kinds of abstract universal theories that people, you know, trot out from the good comfortable chairs in the academe are seen by on the grounds people, you know, NGOs and feminist critiques and so on, to be unworkable, that they don't actually quite apply in third world situations, particularly with subaltern groups, you know, women, undercast, and children, and so on, because the framework is assumes very much a kind of utopian society, which, you know, the Western liberal society is moving towards, and it already has structures that might support some of these elements, whereas the third world countries don't have those sort of structures that can support, and they work with a social order that's in fact in some ways much more complex, the social system in these countries. For example, you know, if you have we have caste, class, ethnicity, regional language divides and on all kinds of complexities, religious divides as well, denominational divides that cut across many vectors to try and sort of bring them all into order by these more abstract principles is not, you know, it's not entirely workable. Then there is a further sort of suggestions that have come from someone like, you know, John Rawls with the theory of justice, and justice as fairness based on the idea of fairness. This is a system that begins by assuming that there is no hierarchy, there are no divisions, there are no caste, there are no class. Just sort of almost, you can imagine, people like Immanuel Kant with no presuppositions about who they are, where they are, sort of an abstracted sitting and deciding what would be fair. And then you go and take and apply to that. So whatever is not fair, you try and balance them out and so forth. It's a very liberal kind of an idea. And it's called the veil of ignorance. So, you know, you sit behind a veil of ignorance, not even aware of your own social placements and so forth. And so, you know, people have attacked it. This sort of Rawlsian parda is actually occludes, hides the realities more than, you know, reveals anything. So for him, it reveals the principles which are supposed to come out. But for others, and Amartya Sen included, would argue that what it actually does, it doesn't tell you anything about the social realities and so forth. How can you think about justice and so forth if you're not really referring to the actual social realities as messy and as hierarchical or as, you know, group-based or affiliation-based or whatever it is? You have to take into account, you know, quite a lot of micro effects as well, rather than think that, well, you know, here are the goods and we'll just dish them out and balance the equilibrium wherever there are imbalances. So these are the kinds of criticisms that have been coming out of more or less the third world countries. And the other, the last point on this, and this people like Gayatri Spivak and people have pressed, is that these universalist theories of justice that sort of assume some kind of a homogeneity in societies, or even if they don't assume, they would want to bring about more of sort of homogeneity in a social setup, is actually grist to the mill for multinationals and corporates and so forth, because that's exactly what they would like to do. They would like to say, yes, you know, there are some inequalities and so on and so forth, but we can fix that. We'll set up more factories and give you jobs and so on and so forth, right? And so that's the sort of market, you know, you make bring them into a sort of a market economy. And even Yunus, Muhammad Yunus, you know, his sort of Grameen Bank and so on, once he started to sort of run out of money, he made deals with you know, big multinationals, Ford or Nike, and so it was Vandana Shiva publicly lashed out against, you know, the Nobel Prize that he was being offered, on the claim that it's only after he made these deals with multinationals and corporates that they decided to give him Nobel Peace Prize, which I'm not sure if that's entirely true. But there's some truth to the fact that, you know, it's not all just through setting up Grameen Bank that the problems can be addressed. That's just the beginning of the issue. But it's more to do with where the money is coming from and who you're ultimately responsible, you know, your liability is to. So it's the World Bank, IMF, and so on who end up having the last say. And this happened in Bangladesh in the case of public health. There was a very good policy being set up by people, you know, of the kind of wisdom and intention as Yunus, and a wonderful public health system. That really would have been far advanced than India, would be almost like sort of model of Australia and Canada. Although I think because it's in the UK, it's sort of turning backwards now somewhat, isn't it? And haven't sort of studied what's happening within healthcare system here. But anyway, that was really about to go ahead, about to be launched. But then the World Bank, IMF, and some multinationals got the whiff that this would mean a loss for them, you know, pharmaceutically and in other ways, and managed to turn the whole program around. Absolutely criminal. And so Bangladesh today is without a welfare system that it could have had. It's much more manageable in some ways. But that's what happens, you see. And in fact, the arguments used were Rawlsian arguments. But this is just the model that they have does not fit with Rawlsian theory of justice, which is quite remarkable. So such a strategy for justice would be seen, for example, by radical liberationist elements in third world regions as retrogressive by comparison to the progress they have made along the lines of perhaps simple-minded or indigenous mixtures of Marxist socialism and religious sensibilities in the context of their own particular socioeconomic realities, which have helped raise consciousness about the need for justice without being bogged down by intricacies of the correct or the most desirable theory, qua theory of justice, and equity in distribution of desired goods and resources, and differences on the ground with which they have been historically attuned to live, within which they choose to flourish, and which rather helps them to culturally embellish their particular society. The Rawlsian programmatic smacks of an old fashion universalism. So the other issue is that there is a sort of a messiness about looking at, you know, these issues at the ground level. I think I've already mentioned this point that the utopian approach to the question of women and gender can leave unasked some of the embarrassing sort of questions that come out from the grassroots, the cultural underdogs, if you like, the disadvantaged, and areas where the kind of, you know, the comparison would be the sort of utter ignorance of, say, the American people at the time of slavery, to know exactly what, you know, the ramification of what slavery was, you know, or not just the American, the whole white world really had. Now they look back and think, you know, it was a horrible practice it was, but at that time they had no idea. They did not even realize that we were looking upon the indigenous people, the slaves and so forth, as basically subhumans, as non-humans. You know, they were to be treated in any way you like. This is in Australia. It wasn't until about 1957 that the Aboriginal people were accorded the status of human beings. I mean, this is and you know, so all the theories of justice of Immanuel Kant and so on and so forth, where was it? I mean, what was it doing? You know, they were arguing endlessly in the philosophical corridors about Immanuel Kant's, you know, categorical imperative and so forth. You just looked out the window and, you know, someone goes and shoots an Aboriginal person like a dog, and no one raises. In fact, I've read articles about justification of racism, you know, and in using Kant and people like that. This is what ends up happening with this sort of utopian principle. So this is why the feminists, Spivak, and people have been out to get the man, as it were, the male theories. Okay, again, an account of capabilities of need against the backdrop of highly qualified universal notions of justice allows for a microethical formulation given the local culture, history, climatic conditions, and customary laws. So it's a kind of an interactive theory of justice with care ethics that people like Gilligan have evolved is the way forward, is what this volume is suggesting. So now I'm going to case some case studies with that as a background to show the sort of slightly different ways in which these issues can be handled. Case studies and reports. India, the largest, the world's supposed largest democracy. I mean, people keep saying India is the world's largest democracy without sort of qualifying as to what the hell that might mean. Means the largest number of votes that are cast in an election. Means that, you know, people actually are able to choose their leaders. You know, sans corruption and all kinds of, you know, electoral processes that gets the leaders chosen in Delhi into power, and so on and so forth. India has in recent decades been besieged by a number of critical issues in the areas of justice and democracy, especially where tensions between different communities have run dangerously high. Such conflicts, which lend a challenge to the stability of the Indian society and its egalitarian aspirations, are marked by a number of deeper structural concerns that have a much longer history. And these are the issues that I take up here concerning gender justice and personal law. Rather than all of law, I'll focus on personal law. I'll tell you about that, and then some bioethical challenges. Anandita Balsov and Mandakranta Bose, they always have to be Bengali women, Mandakranta's book is there along with Spivak, I guess, informs of a seemingly contradictory text in the ancient Indian tradition on the role and position of women in ritual processes as well as in everyday life. They point to a deep tension between universal truths about ultimate values and human flourishing as articulated in certain Brahminical texts and the denigration of women as she uses the word niriti. I'm not quite know where she gets it from. Niriti, the personification of evil, women is the sort of niriti, the denial of Rita, maybe, yeah. Okay. This tension is marked more visibly by the dharmas or duties described for all humanity and certain others specially prescribed for women. So this is what's called as Stri Dharma. The women have a certain kind of a dharma, which is Stri Dharma, which leads in ultimately to also the sort of offering, sacrifice of the women to the, you know, to the men's ends, literally. The ramifications extend to gender hegemony in theory formations and applications in wider social legal spheres to the present day. Take, for instance, dowry death. Data compiled for 2008 by the National Crime Records Bureau showed that there were 8,172 reported dowry deaths in the country. And for the same year, there were 81,344 cases of reported cruelty towards women by husbands and relatives. The actual numbers are probably much higher since many cases go unreported or are reported as suicide. In 1992, Amartya Sen calculated that 37 million women were missing in India. The UN in 2001 estimated that there were 44 million missing women in India. Now, this is, of course, the feticide, dowry, sati, although there have been very few cases of sati, but various ways in which women who should have lived, or the female who should have lived, is not there now, from one end of life to the other, or an in between. I'm going to come to infanticide and so on a little later, but I want to move to personal law. Now, personal law, it's a term that the British had used, but you'll see what it means. I'm sure most of you know. Under British administration, the East India Company and later sovereignty, British Charter for India, the Westminster and common law models were being introduced. Until then, anything like the Austinian Roman notion of law as a universally or nationally applicable legislative possibility was absent in India. So they had sort of notion of dharma, which never did translate entirely into the kind of system of law that we've inherited in our system. The Napoleonic Code, the Austinian Roman model, and of course the common law in Britain. Nevertheless, the erstwhile diversity of customs, culturally rooted practices of jurisprudence, the existence of vastly different regional legal dispensation systems, sort of a bit like the panchayat system now, and group identity or community membership configurations rendered the imported rule of law, in quotes, rule of law almost unworkable. The British, in consultation with indigenous legal mentality, devised what came to be called Anglo-Hindu and Anglo-Muslim laws, and there was sort of plus a separate personal laws for Indian Christians and Parsis as well. Although these govern a narrow area of personal or private community conduct, that's why it's personal, it's sort of private community conduct pertaining to family law, marriage, inheritance, kinship, adoption, succession, collective property, title, and so on. So, sort of pertains to basically family law. So marriage, inheritance, kinship, adoption, succession, but also extends to property, collective and individual property, in as much as there was any individual property at that time. But property inheritance is very important. They nevertheless had specific implications for thinking on issues of citizenship, rights and obligations, including the duty of the state towards its citizens within varying social and cultural contexts. So you could leave the whole thing to the community to sort of decide, but there can be ramifications which extend further. In terms of what you can do and can't do to a citizen within a community, right? So, for example, if there is oppression or there is some injustice involved in that, so how does the state address that issue if it's left entirely, to the powers of the community to determine this? So those are the tensions here. Prima facie, this made room for inequality and preferential treatment depending on which community membership a subject of the state identifies herself or himself by, and under which particular personal law processes his or her case is tried or judged. Hindu patriarchy at one time during Ram Mohan Roy, when he was trying to take the case of Sati to the Privy Council, attempted to legitimate Sati, the so-called burning of the widow, or widow self-sacrifice, under traditional Hindu dharma or religious law. Right? So you can see this is part of our personal law. You shouldn't be interfering with that. While Muslim men petitioned for recognition of bigamy under Islamic law, right? And in fact, they were given. There wasn't a law ever passed to allow Muslim men to marry more than once. It's an exemption. The British wrote in an exemption for them, which is about the same thing as under, because it's law under, it's a recognition of what would be called a Sharia law. Curiously, through rather ambivalent responses on the part of colonial administration, Sati was re-qualified for a while as voluntary culpable suicide. If you've got a legal background, you'd see what a convoluted voluntary culpable suicide, which held that in most cases, the already extinguished victim, the widow, responsible for her action. Because it's a culpable suicide, voluntary. I mean, she voluntarily committed suicide. Well, but what if she was coerced? It's very complicated. It's not as easy. And on bigamy, technical concessions were made for desiring Muslim men only, although a few Hindu men converted, a practice still in place to take advantage of this deliberate legal blind spot, which led to my divorce. You didn't get the joke. But there were positive demands also, such as blocking alienation of land by individual claimants to what is otherwise a collective or clan title. I mean, the joke previously was that, yes, Hindu men are converting to being Muslim so that they could have more than one wife, or concubine system, which always been there. But the issue is that the Muslim courts will not recognize that, unless it's a proper conversion. And it means the full hog, and no Hindu man's prepared to go that far. Right. So rightful inheritance of property and share for the widow, easing of divorce provisions and maintenance for the estranged wife, the right to practice one's own faith and maintain place of worship, and equitable representation in councils, local and provincial governments, and so forth. So these are some of the positive side of the demands. You know, it sort of allowed a whole lot of things at local level, and recognized the fact that there has to be representation In government, in provincial groups, councils, and so on, and also the, be able to maintain places of worship and so forth. However, the obvious side of the unilateral thinking that is towards uniform civil code would entail perpetuation of an unequal social condition, of the unequal social conditions and cultural disorientation which mark, to a large extent, the difference between the moral communities in terms of available opportunities, gender-based and caste-ordered imbalances, as well as missed prospect for advancement and access to resources for development. A measure of positive discrimination and recognition of social immobility and glass ceiling syndrome on account of one's social status, gender, religion, and caste identity was necessary to deal adequately with the contradictions between groups, group disentitlement, individual rights. Now, what this long paragraph actually says is that, you know, while on the one hand you have the positive, the negative side is also that if you bring in uniform civil code, which means, you know, do away with separate personal laws and so forth, then you get a situation where on surface you'll have a uniform civil code, but underneath, if you haven't dealt with caste system and the imbalances there, how is it going to rectify anything? What happens when you have a social structure where you know, women, the girls will only be allowed to have so much education, and then they're married off, you know, told that they don't have any right any further. There's a whole lot of things that are going on at a structural level, which just passing a uniform sort of civil code is not going to deal with, which the British recognize, and they recognize it to their own detriment, that eventually it's those very injustices that remain because they couldn't deal with it, that someone like Gandhi was able to stand up and say, look, you know, you've really messed up our society, even made it worse than it was prior to your arriving, because you just had no idea how to deal with these situations, you know, and which is largely true. And so they held back from, the British held back from enacting uniform civil code and allowed sort of the differential practices to continue. But either way, you know, I mean, it was a catch-22 situation. You know, sort of, what is the saying? You know, you're a devil if you do or you're a devil if you don't, you know, sort of both ways. So the long and short of it is that if you had uniform civil code, it would just suppress all the problems and because of the social structures and conditions and so forth. If you didn't have, then some of those practices would still continue and would come up on surface, and they would have the right to actually, you know, make things either worse or, on the basis of the religious claims and so forth, make more claims than they could otherwise. And both of these things happen. The framers of the constitution, in the aftermath of the bitter and bloody struggle between Hindus and Muslims with Sikh suffering as the innocent buffers, were torn between giving a universal assent to equality of right, and the recognition that this in itself does not necessarily produce an equitable society, especially if traditional custom system of hierarchic privileges, laws, social conditions, and enshrined indigenous or community laws divide them communally and secure differential treatment overall. That was the point. What model of democracy and citizenship would be appropriate for the decidedly pluralist fabric of this major South Asian society? Now, the founding members of the nation, as distinct from the founding members of the constitution, people like Gandhi, were more circumspect and left the matter in something of a limbo. But the program for our uniform civil law hovered just above the collective horizon or in the newly chartered national conscience. The general consensus was that personal laws are appropriate only for the specific areas to which they apply, such as family law, governing marriage, inheritance, succession, adoption, gifts, divorce, guardianship, and maintenance, as we said, and in law relating to religious institutions and property rights, so long as they work and until such time as the state can find effective ways of either ironing out the differences in customary practices or codify them under one system of the rule of law. The Hindu Code Bill of 1948 was the first such endeavor to codify the vast array of Hindu customs and rules, and was revised in 1957-58, followed by several others dealing with succession, adoption, guardianship of minors, maintenance, and so on. However, the Hindu Code Bill has not been very successful, and it adopts items from the earlier Shastras and Anglo-Hindu law without substantially transforming them. Through technical loopholes in the code bill, a daughter can still be given away at much below the legal marriageable age, as the story of Phulan Devi reveals. Likewise, the persistence of the practice of dowry, and in the case of the Muslim girl, the institution of nikah, marriage, which is never a written document as such, and the age, the ages can vary. And the girl can be given away at almost from the age of 11 onwards. The unresolved quiddity in the 1950 constitution has had a number of consequences. First, it has meant that members of denominational groupings or those whose identities can be linked to such communities continue to be governed by the personal law of the community. This is a definitional matter. Second, since a Hindu is anyone who is not a Christian, Muslim, or perhaps a secular atheist, Jains, Sikhs, and Buddhists are governed by the dominant Hindu personal law. Right? There's no definition of who a Hindu is. It's if you're not all these things, then you're a Hindu. Exceptions are made in some cases, such as dissolution of marriage and other family issues, which are governed by separate personal laws for Parsis and Christians, and by default or complete judicial silence in respect of the Jain custom of terminal fasting and variant inheritance practices. Third, since personal law pertains to family, marriage, adoption, and so on, the subjects, real as against virtual, of these laws are mostly women and girls. In other words, the specific religious identity coupled with gender and community affiliation ultimately undermines the outcomes. Religion under the community, religion and community defines one's family interests and status. Fourth, patriarchy is heavily and inexorably imbued into the structure of personal law, whether Hindu or Muslim. Most traditional systems were thoroughly patriarchal in both the pre-colonial and colonial periods, and therefore feminists arguing in the 1960s and 70s for greater scope for personal law found themselves in the invidious position of supporting patriarchal structures and interests. This is Kumkum Sangari, 1994. All four elements combine to articulate an ideological disequilibrium weighed against the common factor of gender, regardless of whether Hindu or Muslim personal law or Christian law is at issue. And this has been the brunt of both feminist and sociological critiques in the post-independence era. There is a curious ambivalence in the constitution of India, which has found echoes in just about every major case falling under its jurisdiction. Judicial equivocation has only echoed that of the Constitution and is in turn been exploited by moral communities to further their own ends, usually in orthodox rather than liberal directions. So one of the ways in which the Hindutva group has done this is to say that using the word pseudo-secular, that, you know, we've now reached a sort of secular state. What secularism means is that all religions should be given equal recognition and so forth. And now the Muslims under personal law are running off with their privileges and their demands and so forth. And the Hindus are the ones who are being disadvantaged. And so, you know, it's a sort of reached a situation where a minority group, they've even got a minority commission to support them, for goodness sake. And they have all these protections in the Constitution, you know, under Articles 13, 25, and 28, which safeguards the conservative interest, you know, because they got freedom of conscience, religious observance practices, they can have their own schools, and so on and so forth. You know, not to mention that Urdu is not even taught in the entire UP in any public school. It's the largest Muslim community in UP, and they have to go to learn Urdu in their own sort of mosque and their own. It's not a subject even an option. Possibly in all of UP, but of course, you know, the BJP will still claim that the Muslims run off under this constitutional mandate and have all kinds of protections and privileges around them, and of course the Hindus claim, the Muslims say exactly the same thing of the Hindus. But there are discriminatory practices that regardless of all this continue to occur under existing personal laws, while the state persists in an uneven treatment of women and also failed to institute widespread reforms in areas of public and private life where discrimination persists. And this is discrimination within Muslim community as well as within Hindu community. So what the feminists are saying is that the common denominator of this constitutional ambivalence towards personal law is the subaltern, is the woman. And the Constitution does nothing to resolve the difficult question as to whether the religious nature of these laws prevent a secular state from interfering with them, or whether the personal nature of these laws, as distinct from the territorial laws, make them immune to state control. So what is it that makes it so difficult? All that the state, all that the Constitution did was to say, in time, the state will move towards a uniform civil code, but that's just a directive principle. It's not something that can be enforced. A directive principle is something that's sort of written in as an intention, but there's no program for it. Of course, the situation augurs poorly for women of minority groups, as equal legal rights are withheld from them, and also for majority community groups that have yet to gain formal equality in all aspects of personal law governing daily life. Now, this came to the surface in the mid-1980s in the wake of the historic judgment in the Shah Bano case, culminating in the intervention of the legislature towards protecting Muslim personal law in this matter. Under pressure from the vocally active Muslim Personal Law League, in historic about-turn, Rajiv Gandhi, the then Prime Minister, pushed a bill through the Parliament enacting the Muslim Women's Protection Act, which secured primacy of Muslim personal law against civil and criminal court provisions which had been invoked by the Apex Court to uphold the claim for rightful alimony or maintenance for the estranged Shah Bano from a Muslim divorcing husband. And so what happened was there was a chance to actually address this issue, but because of the vote, sort of the vote bank considerations, Rajiv Gandhi did an about turn and just stymied the whole sort of debate and discussion, which left the status quo exactly as it was, much to the sort of chagrin of feminists and reformists all around the country, including Muslim activist groups. The courts now sort of don't, the courts are now much more circumspect. I've read many cases where they have sort of moved away from that kind of. Okay, now I want to move to public health, and I'll just summarize much of it. There are numerous issues here: mental health, the AIDS epidemic, the lack of social welfare and insurance protection or benefits for healthcare, the neglect of the sufferers through natural disasters such as flooding or shortage of water, the ecological and humanitarian fallouts from mega-industrial ravaging of natural resources and habitats, for example, mining for coal, iron ore, copper, numerous other metals, including whatever is used to make aeroplanes with titanium. India has very, very rich mineral resources that few countries like Australia could match. And under the previous sort of the Nehru license system, they were also very repressed. You could not get license to mine these things. Now with this free economy and so forth, any foreign company can come in with 40% investment with the Indian company, and it's all there for you to go. And most of the money goes outside the country rather than stays in the country. And all this coupled with Monsanto's monopolizing and unilateral control over seed productions and use, the Terminator seeds and pesticide. It's a complete record that Monsanto runs in India and other such countries. And this is part of India's entry into the liberal economy and global free trade market, the consequences of which have been sending farmers by the thousands to suicide. But I'll start at the other end of life, the prenatal, before one is even born, before one is even an Indian. Renuka Sharma, in her work on the rights of the newly born, I cited her a little early on, infanticide, the infant, in a developing environment, draws on internal indigenous textual and practical resources to treat of the problem as worrying as infanticide. On the practical side, there is no count of how many postnatal offspring go missing each year. Infanticide figures for the female child have as also the overall ratio of females to males, if not stayed the same after a century of public health reform, have indeed got hopelessly worse in certain rural and poverty-stricken areas. In comparison to China's current one-child policy, gendered infanticide in India is not a state-mandated policy, except for its failure to control amniocentesis, prenatal sex determination. And China supplies the equipment for that, which contributes to this woeful practice. This is a troubling moral issue for the mute and voiceless, whose worth is circumscribed by the values attached elsewhere in the society to the utility of male members and the burdens prefigured by the marital mortgage for the child's happy later life. Feticide is a selective abortion of females by families preferring a son. A study of 3,222 deliveries at one hospital over 11 decades shows that sex ratio at birth, that is the number of male babies born compared to the number of female babies, fell significantly after 1980 when ultrasound machines for antenatal sex determination became available. The sex ratio in second children, if the first was a child, was even lower. If the first was a girl, was even lower. Prabhat Jaya, the University of Toronto, argues that, quote, based on the conservative assumptions, the gap in births equates to about 0.5 million missing females' births a year. A report by Palash Kumar, published in December 2006, says India has killed 10 million girls in 20 years. The report says, quote, 10 million girls have been killed by their parents in India in the past 20 years, either before they were born or immediately after, describing it as a national crisis. Female feticide and infanticide are not the only issues with a girl child in India. At every stage of life, right from basic nutrition to education and standard of living, she's discriminated and neglected and may not go on to sort of... Sometimes if they go past the age of 12, then there's a good likelihood of survival. But under age 12, it could go anyway for them. Punjab loses every... and by the way, this is not in the urban areas. This is really... Well, even in the urban areas now is becoming an issue because, you know, people are living in blocks of flats. They can't afford many children. So who goes first? The girl goes first, even though she might become an IT person but may not be the one who'll get to MIT. Right? May have to be a boy. Punjab loses every fourth girl. Every fourth girl. By the 2011 census, we would be killing off 10 lakh. That's 100,000 girls a year. Every year in India...
1 million.
Oh, it is 1 million indeed. Yes, 10 lakh. Yes, not 1 lakh. Thank you for correcting. 1 million. Every year in India, an estimated 500,000 female fetuses are aborted because they are female. In Tamil Nadu, recent analysis of statistics indicates a shortfall of about 13,000 daughters per year, 67% due to pre-birth deficit, which suggests a high rate of female feticide, and 33% due to infanticide and neglect. So, thus, in the world's largest democracy, a massive crisis of missing girls is unfolding according to India's 2011 census. The latest census shows that the gap between the number of girls per 1,000 boys up to the age of 6 has widened to 914, a decrease from 927 a decade ago at the 2001 census. Haryana, however, has 830 female children and Punjab 846 against 1,000 male child. In some parts of Haryana, it could go as low as a mean of 774 females. Kerala has the best with 1,084 females to male, and the literacy about as high as well. It has the highest sex ratio, followed by Pondicherry with 1,038. Dunham and Dew, former Portuguese colonies, has the lowest ratio of 618. In a country where a large part of population finds it hard to get access to toilet and clean drinking water, access to illegal fetal sex selection procedures seems easier. During 1991, in the prosperous states of Gujarat, Punjab and Haryana, 5% of girls were eliminated. 10 years on, this climbed to 10 to 15%, 7,000 fewer girl childs are born every year than ought to be, according to UNICEF. All right. So finally, some bioethical issues, and I'll finish with this. The topoi of medical ethics, bioethics, and care ethics in traditional Indian moral framework, healing practices and medical treatises, is examined against the displacement by the dominance of science and technoculture in India with colonialism and the roots of modernity, leaving behind a wrecked public health system. Some of the issues discussed are taken from the following case studies: hysterectomy on intellectually handicapped girls, sex testing, which we've already discussed, gender selection, terminations, IVF and childbirth, pharmaceutical abuses, hospital care politics, AIDS, IVF syndrome, voluntary death and its criminalization, last but not least, the ethical legal status of what's called lunacy, madness within the confines of colonial, post-colonial institutionalization of mental health care. These are all being discussed in the in papers, which a couple of students here actually are looking at those chapters too on public health. But I think I'll just end with abortion and perhaps a little comment on euthanasia. Here is a kind of a bioethical issue that's very, very challenging, particularly in with modern day bioethics, you know, groping with this sort of difficult issue as well. So instead of killing it abortion right away, let's first rename it in the sort of the almost cognate Sanskrit translation of, you know, something like you know, garbhapata, where the suggestion is that it's a sort of a miscarriage. Okay, so whether it's voluntary or involuntary is not the issue. So miscarriage by natural causes and fetal abortion, especially. I mean, there is a term for that. Of course, you know, it's the brumahatya. But there are some distinctions made within that as well. Anyway, they attract a great deal of attention in modern societies. But these processes are likely to have unpredicted physiological and emotional impact on the woman, the conceiving mother, who has to sacrifice an issue in one of these manners, even if it was an intended one. So the first sort of approach to this is to look at the emotional elements that are involved in here, rather than be, you know, worried about sort of the moral issues of whether or not one has the right or not the right. So that's the sort of first approach, first part, because there are health issues involved, especially of the mother, and to an extent of the fairly barely formed infant, as the fetal growth might be perceived by those intimately concerned. Now, with a tendency towards a more holistic conception of health rather than a part and parcel approach or replaceable organic parts constituting the biological human person, clearly a radical rupture or intervention with what would otherwise be viewed as natural development of the individual, which in the case of the female individual is marked by an almost inexorable expectation of childbearing. Any kind of interruption or intervention in the process would be deemed unnatural or at least contrary to the medical wisdom so understood. That said, however, sharp and clear distinctions are made between the two ways in which fetal growth could be lost, and hence also the ramifications both for a code of medical practice and the ethical issues involved were an intervention to take place with the intent of removing what would otherwise become a fully fledged human person. Again, however, the codes might be presented as rules from which certain regulative principles may well be derived rather than taken as non-negotiable absolutes. This is how ethics proceeds. Then you have certain principles from which rules are produced. This, of course, is a problem endemic to much of ethics anywhere, and we find this not to be alarmingly different in the case of ancient Indian medical texts, whose complete articulation across the board still pending. All right. So what's the verdict? And this is a short piece. In any event, taking Indian subcontinental culture as a whole, a rather ambivalent pattern is anticipated. For example, the interesting discussion emerges of the analog of double effect doctrine in medieval Catholic teaching, whereby in order to save the threatened life of the mother, it is accepted that the fetus could be inadvertently removed, or it may be removed by supplication to the gods without incurring karma or adverse moral judgment on the patient in question or others involved in the process. So inadvertently, your you're removing the fetus, but the rationale is that you're trying to save the life of the mother. It's called the double effect doctrine. Now, I intended to work backwards from this general exception to other similar exceptions, weaving through the negative entitlements of the mother and supporting community of carers as an argument for the right not to continue with the conception at this particular instance. The entitlement of the desirous soul awaiting entry into the womb notwithstanding. There are various views on the time after which a fetus or womb growth may not be forcibly removed. Again, there is the 4 month period is given as a time when there is still fluid involved and so forth, but after fifth to the 6 month, I think, yeah, comes later on, fifth to the 6 month, the fetus is considered to be very well formed, and so, you know, interfering that would be seen to be harmful both to the fetus as well as to the mother. But there are controversies because it's not quite clear that the physiobiological knowledge was really as extensive as, you know, as we have today. So controversies could arise when physiobiological status of the uterine entity is judged against current medical scientific diagnosis, where internal repairs, as it were, might still be possible to rescue the threatened life of the mother or both, and so on. So, you know, you could still go in and do some work and rescue. But I don't think that, you know, that the Hindu principles wouldn't really be too worried about this. So the issues being canvassed are troubling and rather delicate, but the mistake would be to try and derive absolute principle one way or the other. Rather, an attempt should be made to record in greater detail every possible exception to the general rule and see whether to what extent the exceptions might constitute a regulative de dicto vis-a-vis de jure principle in itself. And it's a sort of an argument that one has with, you know, people in bioethics and so forth who keep asking, well, what are the principles then? So and so forth, can you, you know, derive this from that, and you say, well, you can't do that. It's much more complicated. So the summary of this section. Abortion was proscribed in ancient Indian texts, except perhaps in exceptional circumstances. From the times of the Vedas, this practice was condemned, especially except when the mother's life was in danger. So, according to the Rig Veda, the fetus, the bruna, was considered as a living and a conscious being. It needed constant attention by the mother. Abortion was allowed only when the mother was raped, resulting in pregnancy. The sage also prays to the Adityas to remove away from me sin as a woman who gives birth to a child in secret and removes it. The Upanishad took a stringent view against abortion and said killing of a fetus was akin to killing of one's parents. And so it's mentioned in the Shatapatha Brahmanas as well. But then in consequent months, the limbs, if they develops and is threatening to the mother, then that could be a ground for the removal. The exceptions, Bhagavata and Charak, and these are Shusrata, number of them opine that there are exceptions that are to be made in certain circumstances. So with this fact in the background, it could be said that the tension, this is a comment that's made by Arupura and Arvind Sharma, that why we see the tension and ambivalence here is because, you know, it's basically a mythical text. These are basically mythical texts that are trying to figure out an unknown biological sort of situation. And until and unless they could have got this right, it's not quite easy for them to have been able to pronounce one way to the other. So they equivocate because they know that they know their own limitations. They know the sort of uncertainties surrounding that. So what you have are customs and, you know, received wisdoms and sort of which are not necessarily what medical texts should be doing. But even the medical texts seem to indulge in the kind of speculative areas. That's one of the sort of criticisms that has come out. By contrast, there are divergent views among Buddhist scholars regarding the status of the unborn fetus and its acquiring of personhood consequent to the end of life. Whereas in the Hindu system, it seems as if fertilization itself is a period when a person begins, right? And if that's the case, then it becomes prohibitive, because if that's when your person begins, whether for the Buddhist, that's not really the time when a person begins, because there is really no soul that sort of enters at a particular time. I don't remember the Dalai Lama saying something about, no, it's not the conception, it's when the child is actually being born, is when personhood is acquired. And so up to that point, I mean, you know, this is not a person. How exactly? Well, you know, there is no person in Buddhism anyway, in some ways. You know, there is no self. A person might be something that's sort of developed much later in terms of cognitive abilities, reasoning, and so forth. So it's easier for the Buddhists to say that, but it's certainly, you know, not easy for the Hindus to say that, because I think what happens is this, as soon as a conception happens, I'm not entirely okay, but that embryo is branded by, you know, some wandering or destined soul. Say, that's really where I want to go. And if it's not gone there, then there's a sort of, you know, it's a petrification. So, you know, personhood is denied. I have no idea. I need more help in these areas. But one thing for sure is that the answer is to be found in the Hindu concept of what is called dharma. So, you know, dharma sort of comes in a little later, which, according to Manu and according to, you know, various other people, can change. Dharma which obstructs dharma is not dharma, it is bad dharma. So because there is some relativism involved here, the ethical pronouncements can change. So this is Arupura and Arvind Sharma ending the disquisition on this, and I cite them. The point to note is that the application of the maxim is not fettered by the dubious nature of the context. In theory, Hindu ethics is thus in some ways as remarkably context-free as it is context-bound at times in practice. This also reinforces the more general perception that in its own understanding, Hinduism is a hermeneutical rather than a historical tradition. So, you know, it can interpret things differently. And I brought this here. I wanted to show this in the case of euthanasia as well, but I think I should stop and allow some discussion. But we can come back to this if you like. There's a whole section here on the practice of euthanasia and how, you know, atmahatya is something that's been frowned upon. You know, you cannot do that. Self-will death, this, that, the other. But then there are sort of ritual and yogic death. There's samadhi maran. There's Johar jumping in with the whole sort of whole groups can go and commit suicide to avoid being captured or being invaded and so on, and then there is Sati, of course, and various other forms of self death, that, you know, martyrdom too, of course, which sort of circumvent this. And then there's the Jain practice of Salekhana, which is fasting to death, which, you know, Gandhi to some extent tried to use in his own case as well. So there are various exceptions. Johar, as I mentioned, mass suicide in the face of calamity, natural. And the Jain terminal fast is a very, very interesting, and I've done a whole lot of work in this area as well. Salekhana, for those who are bioethicists, may even be seen as an assisted or abetted. Could even be seen to have an assisted or abetted component, what we call the assisted suicide and so forth, you know, which makes the physician culpable, non-culpable, auto-homicide variations. I did this very interesting study with the Jains, and I asked them, I said, would you do this, could you do this, could you do this, could you do that? And they said, yes, yes, yes. And I said, well, you're the most modern humanist, secular bioethicist that I have ever come across. And they said, they didn't understand what I was talking about. But of course, I published that paper in Bioethics. This is, you know, the journal that comes out of Blackwell with Peter Singer and Helga Kusch, the sort of two very rational. And I laid it out right next to them. They were so happy to see me. it became quite a famous paper for I think you've heard about that, right? The paper on the Jain Salekhana, the soul suicide. And, you know, there appears to be a religious sanction for this practice, although the Jains are quick to defend the practice on ethical or quasi-moral consideration, which tend generally to underpin appeal to spiritual telos and so on. Okay, but the Hindus are a lot more circumspect about this, but you know, you could sort of find even within their discussion, if you put the Jain and Hindus together, a whole kind of vocabulary of voluntary, involuntary, non-voluntary, active, passive. These are sort of distinctions that are made in modern bioethics. But the best thing that came out in more recent times was two court cases, and I'll finish with this. This is two people were arrested separately in two different cases for, you know, attempting suicide. You know, one was denied a vendor's license to sell vegetables and he doused himself with kerosene in front of city council, you know, Oxfordshire office and town hall and committee. And the police arrested and charged him under there's a provision within the penal code called Section 209, which treats all cases of attempted suicide equally as an offence and is arbitrary in respect of the quantum of punishment. So the person, if he were dead, wouldn't have been punished, but since he's still alive, would be punished. And in one case, I heard that a capital punishment was actually prescribed because the crime was so bad, because it was a packed suicide, you know, the whole, so he was guilty for the killing of the kids as well and all that. But there is an article in the Indian Constitution which says, Article 21, no person shall be deprived of his life or personal liberty except according to procedures laid out by law. Personal liberty is taken to mean that no person shall be subjected to imprisonment, arrest, or other physical coercion. Now, although this is articulated in negative terms, it is arguable whether this protects constitutional guarantee for a positive right, namely the right to live with dignity and security, as will be contended in the cases. So in one of the landmark cases in Bombay, the judge interpreted this as saying, well, if the state does not provide this poor guy with protection, or with a right to livelihood. You know, this guy wants a livelihood and the state is depriving him of livelihood. Therefore, the state is undermining a right that he has under this constitution. If that's the case, then he has a right to take his life. It's a negative right, you see. So if the state, who's supposed to be guaranteeing your, you know, life to livelihood, is taking this away, then it also follows from that. They're overturning a decision of another court that tried to argue, of the Attorney General, that tried to argue that the Article 21 actually includes a right to life. Not a right to take your life. So you're duty bound to continue to live, which is crazy. Even if the state, you know, tries to, deprives. So this court turned around and says that it logically must follow that the right to live, as recognized by Article 21, will also include the right not to live, or not to be forced to live. To put it positively, it would include a right to die or to terminate one's life. This is a court ruling. It's brilliant. I thought, you know, philosophers in India can't think like this, and the court is thinking. I met one or two of these judges, and they were absolutely fantastic creatures. So the negative inference drawn here is more by way of a reductio or Buddhist prasanga. The contrary belief is an entitlement, or is a valid counterfactual in a possible world, then biological implication. That's how I, and so sort of, that's how I think that they're thinking. So the judges, not only that, but they went on to make some comments about euthanasia as well. So the pronouncement, you know, the no consideration was entered here about euthanasia, but since the issues of constitutionality and medical constraint and other things came up, they said that they said basically that all forms of euthanasia should not be all lumped in together with what was called mercy killing. See, in India, people say mercy killing and everybody runs away because they think that that's a moral crime. So the judges said, yeah, that's not really what it is about. There are other forms of self death that may have good reasons behind that, and that India was way behind on the discussion of euthanasia when other countries like the US and to some extent England and so on have enacted if they decriminalize suicide, so in India, suicide is still a crime. So that's why the person who's attempting suicide is arrested under a penal code, which is a criminal code. You might as well be arrested after you've committed suicide, because that's what the law actually says, basically, that, you know, it's a crime. It's been decriminalized in the US and the UK as well. But not only that, but they've also separated that from euthanasia, except in cases where the abetted suicide was actually not for good reasons, like, you know, medical and so forth, or terminal illness and what have you. That people like Kevorkian in America were trying to peddle through through all kinds of devices they've had. There's been cases in Australia as well. A doctor actually offered, and funnily his name was Nietzsche. So people say, "Oh, this is our modern Nietzsche." he managed to actually get one of the states, which is not a state, a territory, to enact a law which allowed that state to practice abetted suicide, if you like, yeah, as a form of euthanasia. But then the federal government came down and unilaterally abolished that. But it's practiced. That's the point. It's practiced quite widely by nurses and doctors and so forth. Just that it doesn't get reported much, and unless the family kicks up. So there was an interesting case. It was a Muslim family, was a Muslim cricketer from Pakistan, got into an accident or something and got completely bashed and all that. And he was put in the hospital, and the local Muslim community said, "You cannot." You know, they were consulted, because I think we have to turn the machine off, because this guy is a complete vegetable. And they said, no, you cannot do that. Only Allah can take life. So, you know, the poor thing is strapped. So he came as a cricket player, and now he's a complete vegetable. But the Muslim community wouldn't allow. They said, we will not give him burial. No, you can't do that to a Muslim body. You cannot, you know, you could do that even with Gaddafi. They had to give him a Muslim burial. I mean, no one wanted to bury him, of course. You remember? I don't know what happened to him finally. He probably got buried somewhere. But it's a, you know, you would not get to God if you are not given a proper Muslim burial. So this was really a dilemma. So their parents flew out. And they were slightly modern people, and they looked at him and they said, turn it off. Just like that. And if the local community doesn't give us a burial, we'll just hire a funeral people, or we'll take the body back to Pakistan. And I think they ended up taking the body back.
Mm. Where was this?
This was happening in Australia. Well, a cricketer who came to play in Australia was completely, you know, got into an accident. And So that could be, in some cases, could be considered an abetted suicide. You know, just at what point do you turn off, especially with the medical advances that have happened, where you can keep a body alive way, way beyond the potential to actually be living a dignified, normal, rational life. And that makes it very, very difficult to make a judgment. Anyway, I had some conclusions and so forth, but I think we need some time for discussion.
Thank you, Purushottam. That was a very interesting and thought-provoking paper I found. So
that's how I provoke myself.
15 minutes for...
Oh.